so I've been eating these cough drops. I've had about six of them already. But the problem is that they also make me sneeze. So just bear with me. Anyway, what I want to talk about tonight are three things. First of all, it's a very, very rapid-fire survey of my work since 1969, which is when I started teaching at the University of Kansas out of graduate school. And it covers a very small percentage of the work, but sort of highlights the different kinds of series or issues that I've taken on over that period of time. Secondly, it's meant to perhaps introduce you to some issues that concern Asian Americans in this country, and I'd like to show you how those issues have inspired the work. And finally, and perhaps most important, it's a talk really originally meant for art students. Because what I try to do is to demystify the creative process, at least the process that's worked for me. And I hope to show you how my work has always been affected by what was around me. And the fact that I'm a born collector, I've been collecting stuff from the time that I was a child. I mean, my earliest recollections of life were collecting bottle caps and popsicle sticks and things like that. And I could tell you at junior high what I collected in the ninth grade. I could tell you what I was collecting when I was a senior in high school and a junior in college and graduate student, so on and so forth. And I want to show you some examples of those collections and how those images started to infiltrate the paintings and prints that I was doing. So with that, this picture got accidentally advanced. I wanted to show you an image of. Are you going to stand there?
No, I'm trying to figure out how to use one.
I wanted to show you the house that my wife and I built in Lawrence about, it's been about 12 years ago now. She's an artist as well. And you'd never know by looking at this house, but it's in a real cookie-cutter neighborhood in Lawrence. In fact, the house on the other side is only 10 feet away from that side of the house. And needless to say, it stirred up a lot of controversy, and I actually have a lecture that I gave once about this house and all of the controversy that followed after it was built, and all the controversy. It hit the TV stations and magazines and even some books. But the house was meant to be a studio, and it was meant to exactly suit our needs. And what I want to do is, the entire top floor is two studios. And if you go halfway down, that's sort of the separating point between my wife's half and the foreground part is my half. I think I have another, before I change this, there's a lot of stuff that represents some of the I call them accumulations more than collections. I make a distinction because collections to me is this disease of going out and having to get every single one that's in the world. At least that's what I look at. Whereas accumulations are things that, you know, you don't go out and collect, but people bring you and every once in a while, you know, when you see it, you get it. It's like these fish that you see hanging down there on a stringer. They're all plastic and rubber fish. Don't ask me how I ever got started on that, but somebody gave me one. It always starts with somebody giving me one, and then seeing another one, and then another one, and now it's people are you know, they're left on my doorstep, and so they're just all hanging up there. And but if you look way down at the other end, you'll see, well, you see Batman behind him, that stack of suitcases from the 1940s, which is something that my wife started buying for some of her performances. And then I realized that these suitcases were exactly the vintage that the attorneys during the during World War II were using. I saw them in photographs, and so I started buying them and using them in some of the performances that I did. In fact, I brought up that whole stack up to Seattle for a performance I did about 5 years ago that required these suitcases to be seen just for, I think, a period of less than 5 minutes, and it filled up my entire van going and coming back. Next to that, you see a big stack of babies, little baby dolls, and again, that's something that my wife has used in her performances because she works with gender issues. And I use those because my grandmother was a midwife, and I've used these babies to serve as examples of her career as a midwife. So what I'm saying is that some of these accumulations go beyond just you know, the satisfying the need to have them around or to have more, but actually become part of, in this case, performances. That's standing on her end, looking at the opposite end. We just decided that we're going to remodel this place. And it's just, I have nightmares just thinking about doing this. Because what you're looking at right here is actually just a third of the house. The rest of it all has to be moved into the studio. And for 6 months, we're going to have to live in the studio and try to make art in it and cook in it and everything else. And while the rest of the house is being totally redone. So as you walk through the house, there's a collection of, my wife's collection of Cultural Revolution figures. That's just a small part of the collection, I might add. But at the bottom, again, these shoes, you know, don't ask me how I got started on these. Again, it started with the student giving me one pair, and I thought, well, those are real neat, you know, plastic shoes. And then I saw another one in a flea market, and of course, I had to buy that. And now I think we have everyone in the world. Salesman samples, pin cushions, everything else. And I love that case, too. So as you walk around the house, you start seeing all these collections. And these are things that I've only been collecting for maybe 5 or 6 years. I get tired of them and then, you know, get rid of them and then start collecting something else. Salt and pepper shakers. Fiestaware, that was a long time ago. Art Deco, pottery, pictures. See, none of the walls go all the way up to the ceiling, so it's just perfect for, you know, acquiring more things and lining them up and so on. More salt and pepper shakers. This is my Mao Zedong pin collection, which is kind of interesting. I went to China a few years ago and I found where they were selling these. And, they change every pin slightly so that there are no two alike in the entire shop. And of course, the shop has maybe 10,000 pins. And so, you know, they know exactly how to get to collectors, you know. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God, I got to have, you know. And then I realized that no two were alike. But I ended up buying about 200 of them and going back and getting sold. Okay, I'm going backwards now in time. This is 2 years after I got to Lawrence. This is about 1971. And I was married at the time, and my wife and I just got to Lawrence, and we didn't even have any furniture right out of graduate school, so we started going to all these estate auctions and buying things. But of course, you know, along with buying all the household necessities, I also wanted to you know, I was very attracted to tin toys, tin liner toys in particular, and so I started buying them. And it was right at the tail end of their availability and affordability. And so within a period of 2 years, you know, I found myself on the phone almost constantly buying, trading, selling, you know, through the antique trader. And this became a real major obsession, buying these. And I kind of focused in on 1930s as a time period that I was interested in, and especially Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse, which were the most collectible of these types of things. Those little Mickey best figures at the time in the early 70s were selling for about $5 a piece. But what happened was that eventually my wife and I got divorced. And we had kids, and so we took this whole collection and packed it up, and we agreed that when the kids became of college age, we would sell the auction the collection off, and that's exactly what we did when Christie's in New York sold the entire collection. So those little Bis Mickeys at that point were going for about $250 a piece. This gives you an idea of the value of these things and how quickly they went up in price. I also had a separate collection of Mickey Mouse books that were just from the 1930s. And I wish that I hadn't sold these, because now these books are worth a lot more than I got from them at the time. Big Little books. I don't think any of you are old enough to remember these in the late 30s. I don't even remember these, actually. In the late 30s and early 40s, they were, you know, the stories were big print, and then the pictures were about maybe every 5 to 10 pages, and they were wonderful drawings. And so I started making drawings based upon these drawings that were in the Big Little books. This was a 5 cent Coke machine that I bought at a yard sale for $10. And it worked perfectly. It had all the refrigeration unit, everything. It came with the old Coke bottles that you see on the bottom there. But things got so crowded in the house, I had to move the stuff outside, and I put this out on the front porch. And this painting on the left ensued during that time. The painting is called Coke Freak. And it's the front porch of the house that we lived in, and I had just purchased an airbrush and actually did these two paintings. These are both 5 by 5 feet acrylic. The one on the right is called Pinky's Art Case, and that was named after two collectors in Kansas City named Art and Pinky Case. And I appropriated my version of a Roy Lichtenstein version of a Picasso painting in the upper left-hand corner there. But I think two good examples of how those collections that were in the house began to infiltrate the images on my painting. This is called Plaza Hooker, and this face came off of the cover of a pulp magazine, which I also collected. This was called The Big Bad Wolf Eats in the Student Union. It was kind of a fantasy realized, you know, if you shave the black off of Mickey's head, you know, what might be there. Wilma Ships, the bottom is a sort of an homage to Buck Rogers' toy that I had coveted, and then the upper right-hand corner is the Goodyear blimp, which as a child I always remember seeing, because one was situated in Seattle, where I lived. And a self-portrait. These paintings I'm showing you are all were done for one show up in Seattle. And I think there were 8 paintings in that particular show. In this one, I hired or commissioned a photorealist painter on our faculty named Tom Clavercap, who since passed away from AIDS, to do this painting of me in this small space I assigned to him on a canvas, and then I in turn painted the silhouette and the floor on. But this painting was the most impactful of those eight paintings that I've just shown you. And the painting was a result of a conversation I had with a farmer at one of those auctions that I was going to, and he was standing next to me. It was quite apparent. He kept, every time I moved, he came over and moved next to me. And I was there with a good friend of mine that was also on the faculty, art faculty at KU. And he said, excuse me, he says, I was overhearing you speak the language. And he said, I was wondering how you came to speak it so well. And I looked at him, and he said, where are you from? And I says, well, I'm from Seattle. And he says, no, that's not what I mean. He says, where are your parents from? And I said, well, my father was born in Seattle and my mother was born in Idaho. I knew what he was asking. But this was the absolute truth. And so finally, he was becoming clearly frustrated. And he said, are you Indian? And I says, no, I'm not. The reason he asked that is Lawrence, site of Haskell Indian Nations University, which is a four-year university now, but has Native Americans from all over the country there. Every tribe is supposedly represented there. And so I says, no, I said, I'm Japanese American, third generation, and I teach painting at KU. And he breaks out into this sort of GI Japanese, and he says, oh, konnichiwa. He said, you do pictures of them geishi girls wearing them kimonos? And I was just sort of stunned. I didn't say anything. And he said, the little lady and I, back in 1952, this is when I was in Korea, he says, we picked up all these pictures of geishi girls. And so, it was clear that was the only way you could sort of justify me being an artist, and, that was sort of the whole package. Someone that looked like me must paint geishi girls. And so that was sort of the end of that conversation, but it turned out to be sort of life-changing in a way. Because I went back to my studio that weekend, and decided that I would do a painting about that experience. Because that's not the first time that had happened since I'd been in Kansas. When I got there to Lawrence, Cincinnati, that was probably the least diverse place in the planet. And, I was constantly being asked all kinds of things. I was denied a lot of things because, they thought I was Native American. Native Americans didn't have the same privileges as everyone else in Lawrence at the time. And I decided that I would do a painting to ameliorate this issue. And I went out and bought this, what was called the Japan Coloring Book. And it was filled with all these line drawings of Japanese woodblock prints. And I came back to the studio, and I threw some of these images in an opaque projector, and I came up with this painting and called it Tongue-in-Cheek, Oriental Masterpiece. And in it is a Utamaro on the lower right-hand corner and a Sotatsu demon and that famous Hokusai wave in the upper right-hand corner. And the brick wall was kind of a reference to the prints that I was doing at the time that had to do with architecture and brick walls and some things like that. And but what was interesting was in this show in Seattle, this is the painting that everybody talked about. And what was interesting about that was it was why they were interested. And they said it's because it's like a homecoming. It's like you're finally doing paintings like that looked like you. But the irony was that they didn't feel like me. I mean, I really felt like these were foreign because I didn't have things like this around me when I was growing up. And so I decided it might be worth extending this into a series of work. And I had no idea that, in the end, I would end up painting over 50 of these paintings of this size, all 5 by 5 feet, of the Oriental Masterpiece series. So that's what sort of got me into, or making that transition into the Japanese imagery. So of those 50 paintings, I just wanted to show you a couple that were sort of typical of that series. Some of them were single figures. There's a story that goes with this painting too, in that sold to a collector in South America, and the nephew of that man came up to me at the student union one morning when I was having coffee and said, my uncle loves that painting, Body Yours. And I said, oh, great. You know, it's nice to hear that once in a while. You know, you sell something, and you just go off forever. And then the student said, but I have to tell you, he cut it in half. And I said, what? And he said, to get it to fit above his sofa, he cut the painting horizontally right in half and threw the bottom away. It was kind of abuse that all of us, you know, take. This was one of the several landscapes that I did in that series that combines Hokusai, Hiroshige, all sort of famous landscape painters, and then I kind of bluffed in a lot of it into kind of to mimic that style. And then in the late 70s, I kind of wrapped it up with this series, this painting called Kaidan, which means ghost story. And what was important about this painting to me was that it got me thinking about narrative. And you know, people looked at this and assumed that there was something going on here. I mean, obviously there is in the lower left-hand corner. It sort of feels like there's, you know, the center point of some kind of turmoil that kind of ripples out. And I was eligible for my first sabbatical at the time, and so I did it and said that I wanted to do a series of narrative paintings. And the thing that was on my mind at the time were the reparations that were going on for the Japanese Americans that were put in the internment camps during World War II. And I became sort of active in that and was flying up to Seattle and doing things like, you know, silk screening t-shirts and things like that. And so I thought, since I was thinking about that I would do a series of paintings about the internment. And I would do one about the camp that I was in as a child. And the name of that camp was Minidoka. And so this became the Minidoka series. And there are 6 paintings, each of them 5 by 6 feet. And my ex-wife at the time and myself got into a real big argument about these paintings because I wanted to keep them in this kind of Japanese style, this Japanese look. And she felt that if I did that, I would be perpetuating the stereotype, you know, this idea. You know, she says, you know, white people all think that we go home and put on kimonos and eat with chopsticks, you know. And you're helping to promote that idea. And I thought that was probably a very good point. But I was afraid, literally afraid, to do something that upfront about the internment. You know, this was at a time that this was not being done anywhere. Now it's, you know, quite common. But and so I persisted and kept the 6 paintings in this ukiyo-e woodblock style. This particular painting, which was the first one that I did, was dedicated to my grandmother, who was seen writing in her diary that she maintained during the war. And in the upper right-hand corner is my mother and myself. And behind us, you could see these sort of cloud formations, and although it's difficult to see, there's a guard tower, just like the kind that was around Camp Minidoka, where we were located. I need to talk about my grandmother here. She's my father's mother. She was the immigrant and led an incredibly interesting life that began by when where she graduated from nurses training school in Japan in 1903. She's in the, doesn't matter, she's in the upper middle part of this photograph. And right after graduating from this school, she was enlisted into the Japan Imperial Navy and was sent to the Japan-Russian War, which was going on at the time, and was put on a Red Cross ship with all these other Red Cross nurses at Port Arthur, which is the sort of culminating battle of the Japan-Russian War. And she wrote an account of that experience. It's really an amazing story, where she talks about expecting, Japan was supposed to be defeated by the Russians. It was like committing suicide, putting their fleet against theirs. And so she expected to be given suicide pills. And on this particular night, she talks, or she wrote the story about how they all cleaned up their rooms and prepared themselves mentally to die, and then imagined getting these suicide pills. And then they went up to the side of the ship and watched these bodies all floating in from the sea, and they were counting how many Russian bodies versus how many Japanese bodies and so on. But as it turns out, Japan won that battle and ended up winning that war. So she ended up working at a silk factory, and where a marriage was proposed with my grandfather. And this is my grandfather, and he had come to America in 1906, and actually was going to move to San Francisco, but in 1906, you know what happened, like one day out of San Francisco, the great earthquake hit. So the boat swung north and went to Seattle, and he ended up, his intention was to become a dentist, and I didn't know this until a few years ago. But because racism was running so high at the time, he couldn't get a toehold, and he could only get jobs as either a janitor or as a cook. And he used to tell me all these just amazing stories about having to slide out of the back alleys because, you know, he'd be stoned, you know, if he went out the front door and so on. But in 1912, his brother, who was still back in Japan, met my grandmother and said, essentially, hey, you ought to marry my sister. And this is how things were done at that time. And so a lot of sort of family research was conducted between my grandfather's family and my grandmother's family, and the marriage was accepted. So she was to become a photo bride, essentially, because the two of them only knew each other from photographs. They had seen each other. This is a photograph that my grandmother saw of my grandfather, you know, who's in America. And she had just made an agreement, a formal agreement, to get on a ship and go to America to meet this man and marry him. So she did, with 60 other women that had made similar decisions. This is a picture of my grandmother in the lower right and the captain of the ship in the upper left-hand corner. But right before my grandmother got on that ship, she started writing notations about gifts that she was receiving from various people, the gifts that she gave to people. And those notes were to become a diary that she maintained on that trip over. It's absolutely fascinating. I think the trip took 14 days. You know, where she was essentially in the hold of the ship and would come up for air, you know, once a day. And you know, being seasick, and, you know, she went to great detail explaining this trip. And then continued to write about when they landed in Seattle and all of the photo brides ran up to the front of the ship with these small photographs and trying to match them up with the men that were on the piers, you know, and they had their photographs and were trying to match them up with the women that were, you know, hanging onto the railing of the ship. Well, she continued that diary for the next 56 years of her life, which is really, probably one of the longest continually running diaries ever kept by a certainly a Japanese-American woman. There's about 42 years out of the 56 that are preserved in these diaries. They're all written in Japanese, and so they're very difficult to translate. The reason I don't have all of the diaries is when the war broke out, Japanese Americans that were keeping diaries were frequently put in prison just for making a few remarks about Japan. I mean, they might say something like, oh, I really miss Japan, or I miss a particular custom, or you know, something very, you know, now seems very minor. But because of those remarks, they were being put in jail for up to 2 years, 2 to 3 years, without charges. And there were a lot of people that suffered those consequences. So my mother said that she remembers my grandmother burning her diaries. She'd be reading them, and she says, oh, you know, I said this. So she threw them into the burning stove. And as a result, these are the ones that are still remaining. Because of her nurse's training, she became a midwife in Seattle. That's her right in the middle, and that's my father that is standing in front of her. But she was the most active of all the midwives, and came out of retirement to deliver me. I was the last baby that she delivered. And she either delivered or assisted in delivering 1,000 babies. So going back to that Minidoka series, this was a painting that was called The Notification, that moment that we were told that we had 2 weeks, or 10 days actually, to reduce all of our possessions, all of our family possessions, down to what we could carry. And all the rest had to either be sold or entrusted to someone. And so there I am. I was 2 years old, in the lower right-hand corner, my father, some other various family members. This is called the Exodus, or the move to the camps, and there's a lot of kind of cross-references from painting to painting. In the upper left-hand corner, you can see my grandfather, still almost in disbelief, reading that notification. And in the middle, I'm hanging on to my father there. This is a series called the Diary Series, the first diary series I did. And what I did was I got a grant to translate as many of the diaries as I could. And I started with the 1941 Pearl Harbor Day year, and decided that as the translations would come into me, I would start doing paintings about some of the more interesting entries. And this was a Pearl Harbor Day entry. and the entry was, today at 6 a.m., I came back from church at 10 a.m. and turned on the radio and heard the news that Japan had attacked Hawaii. She said, I was frightened beyond belief. I pray that God would stay with us. She was Christian, too, which put her in a very small minority of people. She was Christian in Japan. She stands by the blue radio, which was part of what I was collecting at the time. I had this big collection of Art Deco radios, so it kind of gave me an excuse to paint various radios. And I ended up having this show of diary paintings that travel around the country. And as this particular painting sold, I would have to do another version. So I ended up doing, I think, 5 versions of the Pearl Harbor Day entry. And I also did a performance at the time. This is in the mid-80s. And this was the Pearl Harbor Day entry. It was a 7-act performance using a lot of elements out of kabuki plays. And you can see the figures in black with these spotlights shining them on Superman as he goes up in the air. And Superman, in this case, represented America. And so the performances actually go through the composition of the paintings at some point. this diary entry was when Pearl Harbor happened, they immediately froze all the bank accounts of Japanese Americans. And about 3 weeks later, they lifted that ban and said, okay, you can take $100 out of your own savings account to buy groceries. And my grandmother said a very disturbing thing where she said, I was grateful to America for their large heartedness in dealing with us, we who are the enemy. And I thought that this was just Christian benevolence, you know, gone too far. And I immediately did this painting of, you know, America's large heartedness being represented by Superman, as she writes in her diary. And in the performance, again, that moment that it goes through the composition of the painting, Superman just got through showering my grandmother with money. The Christmas Day entry, where my grandmother said, at 9 p.m., Santa Claus appeared, and for a few moments, we forgot where we were. And in the performance, Santa Claus goes into the audience as Silent Night is being played on this koto, and he passes out origami cranes to the audience that are made out of Walt Disney wrapping paper. So there were 25 paintings in the diary series. I showed you, I think, four of them. And this is a series I did just following that, and using a lot of metaphors and symbols that I've used in previous work and the performances. And these paintings are 5 by 6 feet, quite large. Could be deconstructed. Every single element in there could be broken down into having some relevance to Asian American topics and issues and concerns and so on. Even Donald Duck, who wears a kimono, feeding a pearl to Cinderella, and the pearl referring to Pearl Harbor, and right behind it, a Japanese Zero fighter plane, and so on. It's another painting. At the time that I was starting to get into some of these experimental theater pieces, seeing myself as Pinocchio in the lower left-hand corner, kind of, you know, the paintbrush in my hand, wondering whether or not this is something I should become involved in. I mean, I felt totally out of my element. And this painting, which was purchased by Microsoft, is a big painting. It's 8 by 12 feet. It's a triptych. And in the left-hand side are various events of my life that start from the bottom and go to the top. These are all sort of childhood events, various family members dying, the internment camps, being so influenced by the music of John Coltrane, going to school with Bruce Lee. There are all these stories that sort of open up as I look at each of these. And the first panel on the left had to do with the first 30 years of my life, and then the middle were the next 20 years, which is how long I was in Kansas at the time. And then the right panel had to do with kind of look into the future, which was interesting because I ended up developing heart problems at this time. And there's something very grim and foreboding about that right panel, which turned out to be true. This is a large mural, 12 by 36 feet, that I did in Seattle. This is all enameled steel. A very vulnerable mural in the sense that there's 3 or 4 Disney images in there that are clear copyright violations, but they haven't come at me yet. Then in 1990, I did a series of paintings called Return of the Yellow Peril, and this had to do directly with the failing U.S. auto industry and this new racism that was going on all around the country against Asians and Asian Americans. And I decided that I would do a series of paintings where Japan took over this country, except they took over all my friends that were living in Lawrence, Kansas, and I started with myself. Being Japanized It also happened to be a time that, you know, I mentioned the heart problems. I was monitoring my blood pressure almost on an hourly basis, but I was also teaching at Carleton College for the entire semester, teaching performance art, and thus the video camera in the lower left-hand corner, and writing the script to my new performance piece, which is that blue notebook cover in the lower right. So I decided that I'd do 15 portraits of 15 friends of mine in Lawrence, all being Japanese. And this painting was of Martin Chen, who's a Chinese-American that has 6 degrees, including a PhD in mathematics, and three engineering degrees, and a math degree, and an MFA in painting, and a BFA in painting. And Martin has a sort of wonderful life where he loves to fish. And when he catches a fish, he takes a photograph of the fish, and then he eats the fish, and then he does a painting of the photograph, from the photograph. And then he sells the painting. He sells everything he does. And with the money he gets from selling his painting, he buys bait and pays his rent. And that's his life, and it's just repeated on a daily basis. And I told Martin that, you know, as a mathematician, one plus one, of course, equaled two, but that in art, one plus one had to equal three. This is Dwayne Lewis, who was a one-time heavyweight champion kickboxer of the world. Actually, he didn't win. He fought for it, and he lost. But anyway, Dwayne and I have been friends now for almost 40 years, and every time we get together, we end up talking about race. And for Dwayne, the world is sort of black and white, and he sees himself as, you know, being in the black world, obviously, facing the white world. So what I did was I put him in his kickboxing attire and also had him put on a kimono for this painting. Another thing that I did was I did a photo essay of all of these people that I did paintings of. And this is the one of Dwayne. And Dwayne is absolutely the best chess player I've ever played in my life. He's so incredibly fast. And he actually set this picture of himself in this karate pose, and he said he just wanted to take on the white man. So he's got a kimono on as well. This is the famous writer William Burroughs, who spent his last 18 years living in Lawrence, and was lived pretty close to me. We became pretty good friends. And Burroughs was an avid gun collector, and as you may or may not know, tried to shoot an apple off his wife's head and missed and shot her between the eyes and killed her, and left the country for a period of time, went to Mexico. But Burroughs was a cat lover, which explains all the cats that I put on the kimono that he's wearing here. And he's also carrying what was his favorite weapon at the time, was this derringer that he got. And it's one of those ball and powder loading derringers, you know. So I wanted to take a picture of him. And so I asked him to put on this kimono and point the gun at me. And he got very nervous. And at first he refused, but his hands were shaking just pointing that gun at me. But I knew that there was no way, you know, that he could accidentally load that gun, being a ball and powder type, you know, that it would probably take him an hour if, you know, he was capable at all of loading that. So we finally got these photographs shot. But he was an amazing, amazing icon to have in Lawrence. The performance that I was writing when I was at Carleton finally came to fruition in the mid-90s, and the opening prelude was this person who played my grandmother reciting the story that she told about the Japan-Russian War. And it was divided into three acts. The first one was the immigrants, the Issei, the first generation, and these are the photo husbands hanging above the photo brides, who sort of danced into America, as the way I portrayed it, and they're wearing Mickey Mouse ears. and wearing galoshes. And the second act, which we actually took on tour for 3 years, was dedicated to the Nisei, or the second generation, who I felt, I've always felt, took the brunt of the war. And at this moment, this figure is singing Tiny Bubbles, lip-syncing to Don Ho, and Pearl Harbor's going up in flames behind him. It's a very magical moment. And then the third act was my generation, the Sansei, and which had to do with, dances, doing the cha-cha, stealing hubcaps, and being called model minorities. And then I did this installation in New York City on 42nd Street when they were changing all the porn shops to legitimate businesses. And they assigned me the oldest porn shop in America, they claimed. And they gave me the storefront for 1 year. And I did this piece called Yellow Potluck, which was a very sort of tongue-in-cheek and very snotty reference about this Japanese guy that has a potluck, and his lady friend, who's blonde, comes to the potluck. And she's wearing a kimono. She's wearing a Kappa Kappa Gamma t-shirt with this kimono over it. And then she wears this geisha wig on top of her blonde hair. And there are a lot of other sort of accoutrements that sort of give away the fact that this is a very, very sort of unhealthy situation here. She drops her shopping bag that she brings to this potluck, and it's filled with things like, you can see water bread, McCormick's teriyaki sauce, Campbell's wonton soup. You know, wonton's Chinese, by the way, it's not Japanese. And she drops her purse that's filled with all of these kind of racist toys, which are all parts of my collection of things, including white paint that she sprays, turning everything white. And at the opening, because in my paintings I was dealing with this issue about the fact that it used to drive Japanese Americans crazy that white people couldn't tell the difference between Japanese and Chinese, And that wasn't quite so difficult for us that were members of one group or the other. And so I decided, since my storefront was had to do with Japanese and Japanese-American issues, I would confuse it by having a Chinese woman at the grand opening, press opening, actually. And she... I hired this woman named Kuang Yu Fang, who is Ang Lee's sister, the movie director. And she's a Chinese opera dancer. And I put her in this Western dress, and there was this Chinese opera music going, which, of course, no one ever figured out. I mean, to me, I'm looking at this, the kimonos and all these things that are Japanese in the storefront, and listening to this Chinese music, and it was just such an aberration, But there wasn't one person there that picked up on that. And Kuang Yu Fang would pass out these fortune cookies to the member of the press, and you opened them up, and there was a fortune in there that says, "Fortune cookies are not Japanese." But it turns out, when we were done with the show, Kuang Yu Fang told me how upset she was because she says they're not Chinese either. I did a series of works called Thrift Store Haiku, and I worked with these poets, Asian American poets in California, and I constructed these objects out of old stage props that I had, and still life props and all that. And I showed images of them to the poets, and they in turn wrote haiku poems about, what they thought the piece was about. And these poems were displayed next to the piece. This was about the model minority, it's myth, the idea that Asian Americans excel so much in the classrooms that, Caucasian people don't like to be in the same class because they screw up the whole curve and all of that. It's totally untrue. And coming from Seattle, I could cite you figures that would prove that, that these things are totally untrue. But I found these glasses, you know, with these slatted eyes, these, you know, and this again was something I was collecting at the time, starter types, with this banana nose. And what that meant, I had no idea, except I knew what a banana was. You know, in Asian America, a banana, you're yellow on the outside, but white on the inside. And so it just seemed suitable to put this banana nose over the banana. It was almost like putting a condom on the banana. And what that means, I have no idea. But it seems to mean something interesting, you know. And so I used it. And so there were, I think I did 35 of these pieces. This was one that, see that small blonde woman in the drawing? That's actually a drawing I did in the first grade. And my grandmother saved all of my drawings that I did from the first through sixth grade. But what I found to be so fascinating was that every time I drew my mother, I drew her with blonde hair. And no one ever said anything to me about it. You know, and here's all these family drawings, mom, dad, my sister, me. Who is this blonde? That's with my dad, you know? It's my mother, you know? And I'm sure that the idea was that I wanted her to be perfect. And what's more perfect than, you know, having blonde hair? And that was especially interesting to me because a lot of the paintings that I've done since, I've used Andy Warhol's Marilyn Monroe to serve as that same icon. We'll talk about that one. This is a piece called 115 Misspellings of My Last Name. And over a 15-year period, I actually collected every time my name was misspelled, I cut it out and saved it. And so these are all different spellings, and I'm over 200 now. And the word chikataganai, which is also misspelled intentionally, there should be no C in there, is a very famous Japanese saying. You throw your arms up and you say, what are you going to do? You know, and so it's sort of appropriate here. And then I did this piece called 24 People For Whom I Have Been Mistaken. Since all of us Asians look alike to all of you people, this is actually true. Every person that's in here, I have been mistaken for. And the members of my own family, two white guys in there, and there's a Chinese woman. And coming down the right side, second row on the right side is the famous painter, Hung Lu. And Hung Lu is a good friend of mine. She had a show in Kansas City, and I went in to surprise her, and I went to the Kemper Museum and got to the front door, and these two blue-haired ladies opened it. It was like the seas parting, and I walked in, and they said, you must be Hung Lu. So, anyway. Okay, we're getting to towards the end here. This is a picture of my mom, dad, and myself in Minidoka concentration camp, southern Idaho. This is my grandmother, who was the one that kept the diaries, and myself in camp. There were very few photographs of people taken in camp because it wasn't allowed until right at the end. And I did a series of paintings called An American Diary. These were just very small, 11 by 14, sort of like snapshots. There were 30 or 35 paintings. And it traveled for, I think, 4 years to 12 museums around the country. These, again, were entries from my grandmother's diaries, but at this point, they no longer look Japanese. This was the first day that she said the bus pulled up to the camps, and she looked at it and said she couldn't believe that this is where they were going to have to live. This was a book I did, artist book called Memories of Childhood. And this is when I was with the Bernie Steinbaum Gallery in New York City, and she asked all of her artists to try to recall their first 10 memories of life, and mine were all in the camps. And so I'm showing you three of them here. I remember my third birthday. That's the first memory I have of life, and it was in camp. And I remember my friend next door coming to visit me in camp, and we talked through the barbed wire. My collection of stereotypes, these are mostly Chinese salt and pepper shakers. They're all different. I think I have 450 pairs. I'm real close to having them all. What's interesting about these is that they're all made in Japan. They're not very flattering. It's my collection of what were called patriotics. These are pre-stamped or printed envelopes that have these very gruesome depictions of Japanese people that, you know, people used to send their mail. And I have about 150 of these now. Again, we are real close to getting them all. These are Jap hunting licenses given away by drugstores, barbershops. Everyone had their own version. The one on the right there, this is a Jap hunting license with that, the figure is Dr. Seuss, believe it or not. And he actually, during World War II, did propaganda drawings and depicted Japanese and Germans this way. And his book just came out, it's been reprinted, and the image that they took to publicize for all the kids and their mothers to buy was Cat in the Hat standing next to this image. This is part of my collection of masks, stereotypes of mostly Chinese people. Halloween masks going back to the 1920s, and some of these were handmade in Europe. But it's interesting, most of them kind of take on that Fu Manchu appearance. Targets from World War II that were still being used in the Korean War. And I did a series of paintings called A Jap is a Jap, trying to convey this idea of a day not going by that, in Kansas at least, not a day would go by that I didn't feel or realize that I was, you know, a member of a minority. And again, this comes right off some of those postcards that I had been collecting. You know, they couldn't get the eyes slanted enough, skin yellow enough, teeth big enough. And I did this painting. This is a big painting. It's 5 by 6 feet. It's called 83 Dirty Japs. And there are actually 84 squares, but that 84 square is me kind of mimicking these images. But these were all issued images right out of my collection. And this is comes out of another series called Forever Foreigner. And it's that idea that if you're Asian, you're assumed to be a foreigner in this state or in this country. And constantly I'm asked, you know, when did you come to this country? You know, in fact, sometimes after giving talks like this, during the question and answer, someone will say, well, what part of Japan are you from? You know, there's something about that appearance that is just really tough. So I put myself in the context of being foreign here. This is kind of a comic version of that. These are all current or past Japanese superheroes. Okay, this is a series I did called Stereotypes and Admonitions, and these are actually stories that I'm going to tell you this story. This happened in South Carolina, Florence, South Carolina. A good friend of mine had my wife and I down for a weekend at his mother's place. And I guess I can say it now, but she used to, she's the wife, the widow of Melvin Purvis, the G-man, famous G-man that killed John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Babyface Nelson. And his son was a schoolmate of mine, Alston Purvis. And Alston invited my wife and I to come down and meet his mother. And so we went down there, and Alston said, "You're going to have to meet my aunt Fran." He says, "She's like this charming person. She's the most sophisticated, experienced, you know, person. You'll love her." So we went to this party, and it was, we're talking Deep South. We're talking, you know, African-American maids, more like slaves. Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely horrifying, the whole experience. And we were the tourists from Japan that were visiting her son, Alston. And she asked us, she said, "Well, what kind of religion do you folks have back?" I said, "Well, you know." I said, "Well, neither one of us really goes to church, but we're both Methodists, you know, or she's Episcopalian, I think, you know." And then he says, "Well, what kind of food do you like? You know, we're going to cook you dinner tonight. Can y'all eat our kind of food?" You know. And we finally just, we realized that that was our role. And so we just kind of accepted it and ended up telling these incredibly, you know, these lies about ourselves as faux Japanese, you know. So anyway, at this party, Fran finally comes along. And she comes up and she comes, you know, and shakes my hand. And she says, "I'm Fran. What's your name?" I said, "I'm Roger. Nice to meet you, Fran." And she says, "What's your name?" I said, "Roger." She says, "Mine's Fran." And I said, "I know." And she says, "Well, my name must sound as weird to you as yours does to me." This was during the Iran hostage crisis, and I was out jogging. That's not, yeah, it's me, John. And I saw this pink pickup truck coming in the other direction. And as it came towards me, I could tell it crossed the highway, and I knew this was going to be trouble. And just as, you know, we got next to each other, he slammed on the brakes, and he, you know, flipped me off, and he said, "That's for your Ayatollah, you Chinaman." This is a painting called Nikkei Story, which was sort of a sum total of, you know, my life for three generations. I won't go into it because time is running short. And I wanted to show the series of paintings that I'm working on right now, just to show you three or four examples, and then I'll be done. And this is all about camp. This is called Minidoka on My Mind. And this particular painting is called Shadow of the Enemy. And this one is called Classmates. This is called Night Watch. This is 5 by 5 feet. Painting, it should be a lot darker than it appears. And this is a lithograph called American Guardian. I believe that's the last one. So thank you very much.
Yes, Roger's willing to entertain questions.
Questions? That was 1969. It was en route to Kansas. Yeah, it's just amazing. I went back to that area. I mean, it was creepy, to tell you the truth. It was nothing like we expected. You know, we had been told the South had changed and everything else. And the first thing that happened when we were downtown Florence was we were harassed in the streets. These, you know, three guys, you know, came up and started pushing us around and everything. My wife, who was pregnant, you know, and this other friend of mine, who's third generation Portuguese American, and myself, you know. So we went into a movie theater to get off the streets. And then they wouldn't take our tickets. You know, I mean, it was just one thing after another. It was for me, it was like a time warp. You know, I didn't know that we were still doing these things. And of course, my friend also thought it was the funniest thing he ever saw. You know, and what was so horrifying was they ended up, after they finally accepted the fact that we were not, you know, tourists from Japan, then we became Yankees to them. You know, we became people that did not understand what the South was all about. You know, and so to show us, and there were about, I'd say, between 15 to 20 people there at this party, dinner party that they threw, and some of them young politicians, you know, and very close friends with Strom Thurmond. You know. And so they said, we're going to give you an example about how you don't understand us. And she called all the maids in. And the maids came in. And he says, okay, we're going to tell nigger jokes. You know, and one by one, they went around the room. And everyone had one, including the maids. You know, and that was the endorsement as far as they were concerned, that this is, you know, we could get along. We could all get along, you know. And we were just stunned. I mean, we didn't know what to say. You know, I was just absolutely speechless. Fortunately, it was late in the evening, and that was, you know, that was it. That was dessert as far as I was concerned. We were out of there, you know.
Yeah. You get to travel a lot and visit with students. What about the current generation of students who have Asian ancestry? I mean, when they see this work and talk to you, where does that go?
That's a good question, because I've had some, I had an experience at CAA once. And there was a panel, and they had this very sort of multicultural group of artists up there. If Hung Lu was one of them, actually, but you know, there was a whole group of artists up there. I guess they were all Asian American artists. You know, I was sitting in the back, and in front of me was this blonde-haired Chinese American kid. You know, very young. I mean, you know, I don't think he was even 20. But he was sitting in there, and sitting right, and I was wondering what he was thinking of as all these people were up there telling their stories, you know. And so finally, when it was done and they took questions, he was the first one to raise his hand. And he stood up and he said, what's wrong with you people? To this very distinguished panel of artists, he said, what's wrong with you people? He said, are you not proud to be Asian? Why do you have to bring up, you know, these things? He said, look at me, I'm proud, you know. And there's just this sort of deathly pall. No one knew what to say, you know. And I would like to think that a lot of those people had, you know, had a lot to say, but so much to say, they didn't have the time to say it, to sit down with this kid and say, listen, you know. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, when something like that happens, there's a certain element of I mean, that's problematic, because there are people that want to hear that, you know, and I think he sort of did that, and I don't think any of the responses that came up after that was nearly adequate. But I know that young kids, all I have to do is look at my own kids, you know, they're extremely different than me. I mean, I've always said that, you know, the history of Japanese Americans ends with me, because I knew my grandmother. I knew the immigrants, and I knew the language. I heard the language. I know what it's supposed to, you know, I know what the food's supposed to taste like, all that. But my kids, who are 100% Japanese blood, you know, because my first wife that I had these three kids with was Japanese American like myself, they never knew their great-grandparents. My daughters took a Japanese course, you know, language. And I heard her speak Japanese. I was horrified. I mean, oh my God. You know, I about broke down in tears. But I realized just at that moment that that's what was happening, you know, that this history was done. You know, I have three kids. Two of them are married. One has, you know, a partner she lives with. But none of them have ever dated another Japanese or Japanese American person. You know, it just doesn't, you know. But yet, because their mother is very politically active in the Seattle community, you know, they have a tremendous amount of pride as to who they are, you know. But they're miles away from, you know, where I am. So, and I find it difficult to talk to them about it, to tell you the truth.
Roger, you're surrounded with 3D objects. Do you do any sculptural work with them?
No, aside from you know, those thrift store haiku pieces, I did one piece of sculpture that's actually... It's being manufactured in Seattle. It's for the new light rail system. It's a 14-high-foot totem of objects that are stacked on top of each other, and it's being built in fiberglass and steel. There's a company in Seattle, because Seattle is so perceptual art-wise, you know, there's so much public art in Seattle and Minneapolis, I should say. You know, they have a system to accommodate that. And they have this company called Fabrication Specialists that do nothing but make public art. And so I did this model that was this big, and I gave it to them. And they just took it from there. And it's just, you know, I've been up there twice to see progress. Just phenomenal. Just phenomenal. And the people that are working on it and building it are all artists themselves that have sort of given up trying to be artists, you know. So it's an incredible system they have up there, and it's also so pleasurable to go up there and just say, wow, you know. And it's supposed to be done next week. It's been a long process. It's been like 6 years.
So I ask a quick question. I thought one of the most amazing things was this collection of the diaries of your grandmothers, and it seems to me like it's a national treasure. I'm curious, do you own those? I mean, do you have those?
Yeah.
Have they been translated, or are they in the process of being?
This has been about 4 years translated, mostly the war years. And then there were times that I remember things. You know, I remember when my uncle, which was her son, died at 44. I mean, this was my father's brother, died unexpectedly of a heart attack at 44. And I remember I was recently married, and I was at a friend's house, and we were playing this board game, and I got a phone call at 1 a.m. from my dad, and he said, Mitch had a heart attack, and he's in the hospital, and you better come down. And I, you know, if he wanted me to come down, I knew he must have died. And so I went down, and you know, to the hospital, and sure as heck, you know, everybody was there. But the question was, do we wake grandma and grandpa up in the middle of the night? And finally they decided, yeah, we have to. And so we got in, my dad and I got in the car and went over to my grandmother and grandfather's and woke them up in the middle of the night and brought them to the hospital. You know, they didn't say anything the whole trip. They didn't say one word. And they got into the hospital, and as soon as the elevator door opened up, you know, my grandmother saw the family doctor there and my uncle's wife and all the kids and, you know, my side of family and all that. And she sat down in a chair, and very stoic, and the doctor came up and said, Mitch died. You know, and she just like put her head down with her hands like this. And that was such an intense moment. She didn't cry, you know, but it was such an intense moment that I always wondered what she wrote in her diaries about that. You know, and so I had 2 weeks translate around that, you know, starting with getting that phone call, you know, and it was just amazing. Just an amazing 2 weeks, you know, where she talked about how she knew that that was going to happen, and she knew the minute that phone rang that Mitch had died. And he had shown no signs of being ill or anything else, but she knew, you know. And, you know, I did a lot of... immigrant, you know, grandparents, at least my generation, all seem to have this sort of sense about things like that, you know. Because when my grandmother died, my grandfather said he was home and the doorbell rang. And he went to answer the door and no one was there. And he knew that grandma died. he just connected that together for some reason, and she did. And another thing, my grandmother said her watch stopped the minute Mitch died, and it did. According to the birth certificate, it was right on the money. You know, how do you explain things like that? One more question. Maybe not.
Well, if there's no other questions, we do have a reception out here in the lobby. And what do I look at here? Okay.
I thought that your paintings of your friends, in particular, one individual,
Dwayne Lewis. I taught for 35 years, you know, and I never brought my work into it. I mean, you know, kids would find out what I did, or, you know, at faculty shows, they would see what I did. But I never spoke about my work or talked about it or made, you know, any formal presentations about it. But I always talk to students about, you know, looking to themselves first. You know, only the ones that seem to be lost, seem to be floundering, you know, have no direction. I would say, well, look at yourself. Tell me about yourself. Who are you? What are you about? You know, has anything happened to you? And just seeing if there's anything there, just waiting to, you know, find a channel out. I do this in my freshman classes. I had a very sort of weird way of teaching Intro Drawing 1. Everybody in the department just sort of left me alone. I had this kind of way of teaching it. I had a series of problems that I had all students do, and they all had to do with this kind of thing, you know, that offered them the possibility that, you know, it was all right there within them, and all they had to do was figure a way of letting it out, you know. And I realized that it's not for everybody, you know. But certainly if I was talking to a person of color, I was talking to a female, it seemed like that connection was more easily made. You know, I mean, if you look at performance art and installation art, there's an unusually high percentage of women and minorities that are involved in those two disciplines, because those disciplines are lend themselves to stories. As stories have not been part of the you know, contemporary American landscape for a long, long time. It was passé, corny, trite, done, you know, been there, done that. But certainly not in the way that's being done now. Now that you know, the field has become more diverse. It's not, certainly not part of the mainstream yet. You know, we're still in chapters, or we have, you know, our own people that write about us, you know, but it's still marginalized. Anyway, okay.
Well, thank you very much.